Chapter 11. Today is Tuesday, i.e. day two of my walk. I wake with a grunt. In my sleep I have unfurled and my arms and legs are straining against the walls of the child's tent. To an outsider I must look like an alien fetus about to emerge from its birthing sack, albeit a sack adorned with the face of Buzz Lightyear. Buzz himself isn't looking too hot either. I can make out his image on the outside of the canvas, and with my foot ballooning against one side of his smile, he looks for all the world like a man with an infected abscess. "Infinity, the final frontier," I mutter from one side of my mouth and chuckle at the idea of this well-loved character sporting a painful infection. Perhaps if he'd heard the buzz of an electric toothbrush once in a while, he wouldn't be in this mess. I realize then that I've forgotten my electric toothbrush. I emit a yell that can be heard from as far afield as a far field. I hate forgetting my electric toothbrush. Sure, I can go to Boots and pick up a regular toothbrush, but non-electric toothbrushes are so lame. FML, they blow. They suck serious shit. I furl again, releasing the strain on the tent's outer wall. This allows me to unzip the zip, unfurl once more, and tumble out onto the bowling green. It's only when I stand that I realize how achy I am. My joints feel like they've gone 10 rounds with Mike Tyson, or simply been injected with extra gristle. My entire body is a hurt zone, a laser-questing term for when you find yourself diving for cover, but then the others find you anyway and jump on you. This is perplexing, since I'd set off in or very close to QSPC. Could it be that I've brought too much gear with me? In my left hand I have a full-size tent bag complete with pegs and mallet. In my right is a map. On my back is a rucksack containing clothes, foods, bedding, wash bag and the survival basics. Rope, first aid kit, torch, whistle, flare and GPS. I also have pots and pans and a camping mug clanking beneath like a cork hat for my backside. My assistant has offered to Sherpa for me, but since she's close to 70 and a woman, I didn't feel comfortable taking her up on the offer. "Hey, my assistant's name," I said to her. "You are not a Sherpa. You couldn't Sherp if your life depended on it." Besides, you should have heard the noises she made trying to carry my microwave ovens up a staircase to my study. No, I would carry my things, but there was no denying my body was paying the price for this bravery. Sleeping in a tent the size of a rubber Johnny hadn't helped. I had to make a decision there and then to jettison anything I don't need on the road and have it ferried to my stopover locations by FedEx each day. I make a further decision to avoid camping. With that decided, I bosh a few painkillers and set off in search of a good British cooked breakfast. The cooked breakfast, or cookie, has come to the rescue of travellers since it was invented in the war. The gold standard, as far as I'm concerned, came at a hotel in Surrey where a few hundred of us gathered to celebrate Gary Wilmot's wedding to Joanne. Gary adored a cooked breakfast and paid for brand new fryers for the hotel and the proviso that they didn't try to do anything fancy. He wanted the classic British fry-up. Lots of choice and lots of oil. Everything was cooked to order, and while it did mean the bacon wasn't anywhere near crispy, that's how I like it. And believe me, the limp pork slices went down a treat. No, Gary would not stand for pre-cooked items being kept warm under catering bulbs. "I spend my life on stage under lights. I wouldn't wish that on a sausage." And he had two different types of cooked mushrooms, a portobello and a button. I went for both. And with a large portobello on one side of my plate, followed obediently by a train of small mushrooms, they looked like a duck and her ducklings had been turned into fungus. Well, I told Gary this and he roared, "You have to say that during the speeches." I obliged, but when the moment came and he broke off from saying how beautiful his wife was to tell everyone that Alan had something to say, I remade the observation but minus any mushrooms. As a result, people didn't really understand what I was trying to do, and I lost confidence in the routine. I'd taken Sue Cook as my plus one, since Carol had unilaterally ended our marriage, and I felt I could use this as leverage to get close to Sue. But as my routine ended, she was just staring at me with one of those withering looks she gives. Footnote. Sue Cook and I go way back. She's a straight talker, and how. She really will go to town on you if you displease her. I mean, she'll call you all the names under the sun. I've seen her reduce John Stapleton to tears more than once, but it's only because she cares. It's funny that she's called Sue Cook when she can't cook, but you will sue. I felt quite angry at Gary for putting me in that position, and we didn't speak after that. If Newton Flotman is anything like Norwich, I know I'm not going to get that level of cookie here. It's a Sunday, and my options are limited to greasy spoon cafes. The kind of places that don't open until 9 a.m. and harp on about their all-day breakfast. Yeah, all day unless you want it for breakfast. Yeah. Luckily, Denby's is open, a small business that has been run by the same family for decades. This is a guess. It's exactly the kind of place I'd hoped to stumble upon. I love this. This is me happening on small, ordinary lives and writing about them, providing a snapshot of Britain, a bit like when Rick Stein visits cheap local restaurants run by grannies and pretends the food is as good as proper restaurants. Yes, I expect to pick up all manner of amusing vignettes. I sit down and peruse a menu, smiling wryly at the use of superlatives. The mega breakfast, as an example, is only the fifth best breakfast they offer. Above that comes the double mega, the king, the best, and the double best. Approaching the counter, I point out that their best breakfast isn't even their best breakfast. "What are you saying?" asks the owner. Well, I know better than to repeat what I'm saying to a man who asks me what I'm saying, so instead I try to explain to him what a vignette is. He seems annoyed, which I put down to him being busy, hot and Greek or Turkish. I order the double mega, and then, still aching, I retreat to the table to lick my wounds, not literally, and apply deep heat, literally. Deep heat, for those of you not aware of the warming ointment, stinks. Its smell is very, very poor. I shouldn't have applied it in a small cafe, but it's on now, so I pretend to ignore the stares and grumbles of the clientele, and read a newspaper which abbreviates surnames so freely, Rue, Cor, Guerre, Burr, that the headliners sound like aroused grunts made by carry-on characters when they spy a buxomly betitted lady. And there's nothing wrong with that. Who doesn't make quiet noises when they become aroused by a big chest? I know I do, although with me, it's more of an involuntary hum. Breakfast arrives and I eat quickly and well, polishing off the wet items, beans, egg, tomato, while my tea cools, knowing that I'll then be able to wash down the tastier dry items, bacon, bread, using the now drinkable breakfast drink. And that's breakfast, bar a brief incident that's not relevant to the journey. Although, if you must know, I spotted a waitress there, fell in love with her, utterly in love, stayed in the cafe most of the morning so I could just be near her, told her how I felt. She didn't want to know, we had a chat, bit of a cry, her dad got involved, and we agreed to leave it there. Might have just been tiredness, but, as I say, hurt like hell at the time and knocked me for six, to be fair. And then, back on the road. I hide my rucksack and tent in a hedge and send instructions to my assistant to come and collect them and then hand them to FedEx. She's not driving at the moment because her blood pressure pills make her hands shake, but the items will need collecting today, so she might have to use public transport. She tells me that Harvey Kennedy is still uncontactable. Doesn't matter now, I tell her, but I'm a bit miffed at his manners. She tells me that his inevitable damnation to the eternal fires of hell might make him think again, and I smile at that. And then I begin to walk. I will walk to Dis, just 15 miles away. As chewed-up bacon and egg course through my bloodstream, I feel my aches evaporate. Well, the aches are back. I've covered 7 miles now, trouncing the previous day's record, but then I've not had to gain access to a business park or carry a caravan's worth of gear in a ruck bag today. As I stroll through the village of Aslacton, pronounced Azleton, I nod appreciatively at the Church of St. Michael, a stone and flint structure. I've always loved flint, that hard, sedimentary, crypto-crystalline form of mineral quartz categorized certainly by this observer as a variety of chert. You see, Norfolk is very much the home of flint, and the home of flint homes, and flint was a substance close to my heart ever since I'd used it as the name of a TV drama I'd devised and had high hopes for.